Dancing Roses. Ho, ho, ho. It's me, Allison. Just wanted to let you guys know that as we head into these long, lean, potentially cold, depending on where you are geographically, winter days, when those other podcasts have deserted you, I'm still here, releasing brand new episodes every Monday and Thursday. So if what you're needing is me with my brand new episodes, check out Allison Rosen as your new best friend. You can get it on iTunes or you can go to AllisonRosen.com. I love you and happy holidays. Okay, bye.
Allison's your new best friend.
Well, more best of, but it's worth a second listen. Reminding you, when you go to Amazon, go to AdamCarolla.com first and click the banner, Help the Pirate Ship Enjoy Your Mangria at CorollaDrinks.com. And without any further ado, Judd Apatow.
This is Corolla Digital.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. Mandate, get it on. And welcome to the show. We got a special one-on-one with comedic genius, Judd Apatow. Good to see you, Judd.
It's great to be here.
Thank you for inviting us over to your place of work.
Well, thank you for that intro.
So I had one of the greatest experiences of my life watching This Is 40 on a few different levels. One, I'm a massive Graham Parker fan.
Oh, there you go.
Huge Graham Parker fan. A nutty Graham Parker fan.
As am I.
And, oh, I knew you were, because there's no other way he would have played such a pivotal role in your film. So I'm a massive Graham Parker fan, and I had Graham Parker on my podcast the night before. Mm-hmm. And I'd been talking to our friend David Wilde from Rolling Stone, and he knows I'm a huge Graham Parker fan, and he keeps saying, oh, Graham Parker's in this Judd Apatow thing, and I'm in it too. And you're probably like me.
Yeah.
And it's probably one of the reasons your wife is pissing you a lot, which is everything that someone announces to you, you immediately downgrade. Like, yes. All right, so he's decided to. First off, it's not a Judd Apatow film. He's probably lent his name to something. It's probably some student doing something. Who gives a shit about Graham Parker? David Wilde, come on. It's not like the camera loves you. This can't be good. Like this. Okay. So I was immediately doing this rounding down, which I do with everything, including things I'm involved in.
Yes.
I just round them down all the time.
Lower expectations, always.
The number one movie as we tape this is Wreck-It Ralph for this weekend, which I'm in. And at the time I was doing it, I was like, some bullshit Disney something. It must be some parent company or some offshore company to Disney. This is probably going straight to DVD. I'd convinced myself this was
biggest hit of your career.
Yes. And although at the time it was nothing, I didn't know what it
was. An annoyance,
a distraction at best. So I said to Graham Parker, oh, well, I'm going to see this Judd Apatow film tomorrow. That you're still in, or did they cut you out of it? And he's so genuine and so, he's so gracious. He was like, no, I think I'm still in it, you know? And I said, but I didn't know the movie was really the A or the B story, or the B story is really Graham Parker.
As odd as that is, yes, because I love those guys, like you love those guys who are, you know, he's one of the great rock and roll artists of all time. He in a weird way, he never got gigantic like Elvis Costello did. All those guys kind of stole his thunder. He came out in the mid 70s, and then suddenly the Clash and punk hit, and he never got giant. But to me, listening to him for the last 30 years, I just always thought, I love this guy. I love what he's saying. I think he's funny. I think he rocks. He's got a strange voice. He's weird like me.
Yes.
And I think it sucks that the world has not embraced him like he's Michael Jackson.
Yes.
And that's always a funny fight between me and Leslie, which is how many people I embrace like that who never got giant that I force her to listen to all the time, as if it is Michael Jackson.
Every ride home from every night out with my wife, because as I was watching the movie, and I was just seeing myself and my wife in these roles. Every dinner goes a couple glasses of wine, then a drive home, and then a me saying, let's see what the 80s satellite station is playing. Exactly. And then it's a quick Men Without Hats.
That's right.
And then I plug in my Graham Parker, and I crank up a Stupefaction or something as loud as I can. I go, but no one's ever heard this song. This will never, nobody will ever hear this yeah. song. This will never get played on the radio. It won't crack the 80s station. It won't crack the first wave station. They will not play Graham Parker. Yeah. And then my wife, I can win her over. Like, she'll go, this
oh,
is
I can't.
Good. Oh,
oh,
you
I
can't
can.
Win
no,
Leslie
no, no.
over?
Never. Never. I've never really won her over to any of this. We had this yesterday with the Billy Joel song Pressure came on. And I'm just, as soon as it starts, I'm like, and I'm like about to have the greatest few minutes of my life. And she's like, I can't do it right now. I can't do the pressure. We got to change it. And then she has her own version of songs that she likes. And I tolerate them, but she's a channel changer. She
well,
will change the channel.
I have the greatest, you know, my wife's a nutty Bruce Springsteen fan. Mm-hmm. So I have endless nights with Bruce backing up Graham.
Yes.
That's the bridge. That's our bridge song. So the movie I was saying on my podcast, speaking of your wife who starred in the movie, I think there could be some Oscar buzz here. I really do. And I know it sounds like so much smoke being blown up Judd Apatow's ass, but I really do mean it. I said her performance had a million layers to it. It wasn't just a comedic performance. I mean, and this isn't just a comedy. It's 2 hours and 19 minutes of...
13 minutes.
Okay.
People get mad at me for that. Okay. I say half hour shorter than The Hobbit. That's how I describe
right.
it.
Right. It was a half hour shorter than The Hobbit of a sort of emotional roller coaster. And Leslie, your wife who starred in the film, had great comedic moments and great moments of sorrow and great moments that sort of mixed the two together. And, you know, there was laughing, there was crying. And I just thought as I walked out of the theater, I said, this could be an Oscar nod. Do you think that
well,
way?
How I look at it is, you know, when you're in the world of comedy, you mm-hmm. don't think about awards that much because for some reason people seem to value pain and anguish and seriousness more than rainbow of emotions in a comedy. I think what she does there is just so difficult. And to go that deep into yourself, to reveal that much and be that vulnerable both in a comedic way and a dramatic way is it's almost impossible. It really took a lot of courage for her to go that far. And yes, people tend to appreciate people who are in costume dress
sure.
or are doing accents. Yes. And that kind of emotional realism isn't always appreciated as much as it should be. I certainly think she deserves the highest recognition. And I feel bad putting her through it. I mean, the whole movie is a little bit of a funhouse mirror of our lives, things we're observing, things we're making up. And it was both a joy and really painful to make the movie.
Well, so many parts of the movie seemed like they were just torn from the pages of your life and your home life and your personal life. I mean, a lot of stuff seemed like, well, you couldn't write that. or you could write it, but you couldn't make it up.
Like
it had to come from somewhere, at least have some kernels of truth in there somewhere. And so then the film becomes pretty cathartic for herself and for you. And then you're having to direct your wife, which seems almost insane to me because I can't imagine. I mean, I can't have my wife drive the car when I'm in it unless I'm completely loaded, which is only half the time. I don't really have a problem with booze, but I mean, like an argument will break out. I tried to write a book and I said, listen, you're going to type and I'm going to dictate. And we got about a paragraph in and fists started flying and feathers and hair and nails. And I said, fuck it. I'm getting a guy in here to write this because this is never going to work.
That's how it works with us. We just keep going. It's because, you know, when you make movies like this, they're a little bit like, you know, it's like a novel where a lot of it is truthful, a lot of it is made up to just make it work, but you are emotionally accurate as to the basic positions that everybody
right.
has. So Leslie will not barge into the bathroom if I'm spending too much time on my phone trying to escape everybody in the world.
Right.
So the movie's a little bit like, here's what I think would happen if she took the next step and we had a huge fight while I'm on the toilet, right. Which on one level is funny, but also a real fight about, like, why are you running away? Why do you need a break from us?
Right.
And so it's both comedic and sad at the same time.
And for people who don't know, the story, This Is 40, is the story of Paul Rudd's character and Leslie's character who – from the 40-year-old virgin.
Knocked up.
Oh, mind me tell you my 40-year-old virgin story. from Knocked Up. And it's kind of interesting because it's got a little element of, hey, we're the Jeffersons and we're gonna spin this one off.
But
it's them and Rhoda. And it's what happens. It's following now that couple, which I thought was really interesting. And the whole Graham Parker comes in when Paul Rudd quits his gig over at Sony and decides to start up his own label. And he's doing that same thing where you're going, but this guy's so good. Why don't people know about this? They should be waiting in line to get his album and all that. And Parker was great in it. And I'll get to more Parker ass kissing in a second. The 40-year-old virgin story is funny because Ivan Reitman, who's not the nicest guy in the world, he's not an asshole, but he is one of these guys. he's got a lot of money.
Yes.
Time is precious. And when he gives you notes on a script, you should implement them. Otherwise, he's pissed off that he took the time to give you the notes and then read it and didn't see any of his notes and blah, blah, blah. So at a certain point about 10, 12 years ago in the middle of the Man Show, Ivan Reitman got hold of me and Jimmy and said, we should do a movie with you two. Mm-hmm. Like I don't know, like a road movie with the two of you, like Crosby and Hope and whatever. And we said, okay. So he said, go come up with some ideas and come back and see what you think. And I said, okay. And Jimmy and I thought about it. And then we thought, you know, it'd be funny if, Jimmy, you were like a 33-year-old virgin.
You had the number wrong.
I know, had the number wrong. You're like 33-year-old virgin, and I was your buddy, and I was going to get you laid. And we went back and pitched it to Reitman, and Reitman, like, someone's got to make a movie about my life where I pitch everyone their fucking ideas 5 years in advance. And he goes, no. He goes, nobody's going to buy a 33-year-old virgin. And we're like, well, we think it's funny. And he said, no, move on. Next idea. So we came up with the next idea. And
I had that a few times. I went out with the idea and had a few studios turn it down.
Right.
So even after, you know, I pitched it after Anchorman thinking, oh, now people will kind of be up for our kind of comedy and these actors, and Carell was so funny in Anchorman.
Sure.
It seemed like a no-brainer. I had multiple people look at me like they had no idea what I was talking about.
What is that? And why? And I know you'll never, in the realm of comedy at least, you're just never trusted. So you just have to get enough juice to sort of be autonomous and own thing.
No one believes in their own sense of humor. So especially in comedy, they like hiring people who have succeeded because at least they could tell their bosses, well, he succeeded on the last one. But if you haven't had a big hit, it's really hard to bring innovative ideas
to
people.
You have autonomy now because I'm sure, because when I walked out of the theater and I said, well, that was a rom-com, essentially, I'm sure, I don't mean that in a degrading way, but it was a romantic comedy, and it was over 2 hours. If he had some guy, if he had a bunch of suits hovering around, they'd make sure it was under 2 hours. So he must have autonomy. That's what I thought. Like, over the cut, over the final cut, over the product.
Well, I have a good... Excuse me. You cut that out later. I have a very good relationship with the studio, but would they be happier if it was an hour and 42 minutes? Yes. Do we have those conversations? We do. But I do think that there is a moment where you start shortening a movie where it gets worse because you lose a lot of the characters and the colors and details that you need. So I like that range of just over 2 hours for movies. And a lot of my favorite movies, like Terms of Endearment, are at that length. Some people, they just want to get out of the theater as soon as they get in. They want a 90-minute movie. But if I like a movie, I'm not in a big rush to leave.
Right.
That's my general theory. I feel like when a movie's a little longer, you're saying these people are worth your time.
Right.
And if a movie's awful and long, it is a painful experience.
Yes.
That's true.
Yeah. I feel sometimes like when movies are short, it's a little bit of an apology. Like mm-hmm. It's a little bit of, well, we didn't have that much to tell you, or we didn't have.
I have friends who have movies that they're not working, and they're like, yeah, but we got it down to 88 minutes. I've had friends tell me that, you know, they're having the issue with it's now too short. Mm-hmm. It's almost not even a full movie, right. And they just keep cutting to make it at least a pleasant, brief experience.
Well, no executive ever got fired for saying pace it up.
That's true.
And when in a place where nobody has a sense of humor, so nobody really has anything they can add to the conversation or to the product, they always just say, pace it up, and that's about it. It'd just be like if you were a personal trainer who had no experience and didn't know what to do with a person, but always said, you should make your cock wider, and just left the room.
Exactly.
No one would ever fire you. I mean, you can't argue with that.
Hard to accomplish.
It's hard to accomplish, but yet you wouldn't go, you're wrong. Yes. Get back here. You're totally wrong about girth. You have no idea what you speak of. You just go, well, all right, but how do you do it? And then they go, well, that's up to you.
Yes.
But you should pace it up and widen your cock. And that's executives just go, pace it up. That's what
I've noticed. Well, it's a tricky environment right now because people go to watch movies at home. They have the Netflix, their TVs. Look how big my TV is.
I got a 75, 76, or 70.
It's at least 70. It might be 80. So I've got a big TV there. And so why would you leave your house? So we're all trying to figure out what gets you to leave your house and pay way too much money for parking and $11 for one popcorn. And I'm hoping with This Is 40, you leave your house because it's an original movie and it's a good movie. But you do really need some sort of hook. And for most people, it's just that it kicks ass, or special effects, or some visual thing that you can't experience on your iPad. You know, this world of human characters and having an emotional experience in the theater with other people is becoming a little more rare, but I'm still going for it. I'm still trying.
I just know myself, and I know that if I sit down and try to experience a movie, especially one that's over 2 hours, soup to nuts, it's not going to happen in my house. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, I'm going to announce, I've got to take a piss, I've got to get a drink,
yeah.
I've got to get something to eat. I mean, as long as there's that pause button that's just winking at me, come on, friend. Come on, we're good buddies.
Yeah.
I talked to your thumb. He misses me. Come on, pause. You're not going to miss anything. It's pausing.
I'm okay with that, by the way.
I don't mind if it
takes days to watch the movies. I actually, when Funny People came out and it was long, I said, you know, people will enjoy this more at home because they can go take a piss.
I find it takes away from my sort of overall experience.
Like Disappearing into it.
Yes. The fact that the phone's ringing down the hall.
I'm not talking about phones. I'm saying peeing. You got to shut your phone.
But I can't. My thing is I'm in my environment.
Yeah.
I am X amount of paces away from my refrigerator, my computer, my whatever, and I can hear my home phone ringing down the hall, and it pulls me out of it. So I like to go see it. I like Funny People, by the way, quite a bit. And I thought it – I don't know if it was underrated or didn't get its due. I'm not sure exactly how to describe that film.
Well, the reviews were good for the most part. Some were mean. Every once in a while, some. But I think that, you know, a movie like that, it was expensive because I wanted to show what a rich guy's life is like. So if you want to say, okay, we're going to make a movie about a rich guy and how when he gets sick, he's in the same position as everybody else, you do need to shoot in some crazy $30 million house, which is expensive.
Right.
So it was an expensive movie. It's a hard movie because there's not that much to root for. You're not rooting for Adam to get Leslie Mann to leave her family and be with him. You kind of feel bad that you're realizing that he's so damaged that he can't see how shallow he is.
Right.
But we know those guys, and I wanted to, you know, spend some time exploring, you know, the darkest side of friends from our comedy world that no matter how much they get, they're still unhappy, and to show how difficult it is to be friends with them, and a little ray of light that he's beginning to see that he should be a better person. But I liked exploring that. I thought a lot about people, you know, like Dangerfield, who I would see at the Improv, and he would go on at 1 a.m. in a bathrobe, and he would go, he'd say to the crowd, yeah, life makes perfect sense. And then you come. And he would go on these really dark rants. He would look at women in the crowd and go, oh, yeah, baby. You'd change my life. You'd make it all work. And it was so dark. And I wanted to talk about that, that fame doesn't make you happy at all. If anything, it's you're suddenly just faced with all the things that are really wrong with you because you can't still be chasing something and distracting yourself. Okay, you've won. Now you're just stuck with this asshole that you are.
Well, not only that, I know you're talking about me. Not only that, but when you're poor, it's bigger than that. Or I'll do a good yes anding with that, which is, when you're poor, you feel like the reason you're unhappy 60 to 70% of the time is because you don't have money.
That's true, yes.
And you it's a pretty easy math to do. You go, fucking eating at Shakey's again. I'm bummed out. Like, if I could just afford something, you know, the Sizzler, I'd be happy. Or if I could get myself into a car with some air conditioning. Or, man, if I could just get my own house or whatever. Imagine the ladies I could get if I drove this car and had this kind of money and blah, blah, blah. So, and then you turn on the TV and every single image is about money and a vacation and a big screen TV and a sports car and all that kind of stuff. So if you don't have money in our society and you're unhappy, it's pretty easy to draw a straight line to just, if I had money, I would be happy. Mm-hmm. And so the celebrity and the famous is part of it, but the fact that you have money and you realize it doesn't really make a difference in the happiness department, that's a bitter pill. And I don't know how poor you've been in your life, and I'm not sure how you grew up.
Well, you know, both my parents went bankrupt at some point when I was a kid, and I got into USC film school, and I had to drop out after a year and a half because no one could pay for it.
Right.
And actually, the reason why I'm a writer is because I was doing stand-up and I needed to pay my rent, and I realized that none of these comics would write for other comics because they wanted to be stars, so they didn't want to give away any good jokes. Right. But I had to pay my rent, so I started writing jokes to make money, and then that just took off. But it was all because I had no money.
Right. And do you feel like you can change fundamentally who you are or who you were, or, you know, this sort of nature nurture argument, and then at a certain point nurture yourself, not your parents nurturing you, but how different can you be, and is there time to change, and how different do you feel?
I am shocked that I feel exactly the same way I felt when I was 13 years old, and I can't shake it. And I really feel like you're wired in certain years of your life to be insecure or nervous, just to react a certain way in certain situations. And I have spent my whole life reading so much self-help, going to so much therapy. But, you know, if I turned to walk out that door and you tap me on my shoulder, I probably would flinch.
Right.
More than was appropriate for knowing who's in the room.
Sure.
My level of insecurity does not change regardless of how well things are going. But how do you balance
that against reality? I mean, you know, you're very successful. You know, you've made movies that have grossed millions and millions of dollars, that this next one's probably, honestly, as somebody who's seen a lot of movies and understands comedy well, this was just a very well-crafted piece of work.
Thank you.
And it just, there's some movies that make you laugh where you sort of realize, maybe you shouldn't even be laughing, but you're laughing anyway. And then there's some movies where you go, geez, that movie was funny, but if for some reason I wasn't laughing. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of all, you know, there's a part of you that watches a movie like a moviegoer, and then there's a part of you that watches a movie like a professional. Mm-hmm. Like, this is my industry.
Yeah.
I have, not that I'm in my industry. This is the industry I could be in if I was in my industry. But this falls under the umbrella of comedy, mm-hmm. and I'm going to watch this comedy as a viewer and then also as somebody who does comedy for a living and sort of combine those two thoughts and share that experience. And the movie was just had a bunch of, well, obviously you had Grant Parker in it, so my pussy was moist going into it as soon as Paul Rudd explained that he had two albums on the Rolling Stones top 100 of all time. I almost like stood up. Goddamn right he does. But I just thought it was incredibly acted and very well directed but written in a way that was, I like something that's a little bit substantial. Like I love Crimes and Misdemeanors because
the best.
Yeah, because laughs and jokes are great and it's hard to achieve. But if you can work in a message and you can work in some sprinkle some salt in with that sugar every once in a while, like then you've really made a product versus just a comedy.
I mean, for me is the trick when I'm making movies. I try to think of a premise that people will want to go to. I try to make it funny enough that people really like the movie. And then it's how much of that can I slip in? How much of, you know, my deepest thoughts and things I'm struggling with can I put in the movie while keeping it entertaining? And it's like you were saying about nature versus nurture. A lot of the movie is also about how do you shake who you are. Paul Rudd, you know, his dad is Albert Brooks in the movie. And right. when you have a dad like Albert Brooks, Brooks's character who's kind of overbearing and needy, it makes you the kind of guy that hides in the bathroom with your iPad.
Right.
Leslie's father in the movie is played by John Lithgow, who you know, kind of abandoned her to start a new family when she was a kid. And that makes you the kind of person who's desperately trying to get your husband out of the bathroom to
right.
pay more attention to you. And even though those wounds happened 30 years ago, it becomes your imprint for your behavior. And so a lot of the movie is also about these projections we put on other people. And it's what makes relationships so difficult is you're not just fighting with your wife. You're actually fighting with like your whole history of how you, your mother, how you perceive women, all your experiences. And that's why people go at each other so hard because they don't realize that's what they're doing.
Yeah. That's where all the energy comes from. I mean, we've all seen it. I mean, when I used to be a carpenter, I'd go to people's houses and I'd be talking to some woman about base shoe versus quarter round, and she'd like start crying and throw her hands up and go, "I can't believe you screwed up the base shoe." And I would say to them, "I've more than one woman in her house. I don't know you. I don't know where this is coming from. Obviously, I represented males and probably her father, and God knows what the hell went on with him. But these tears." From we've known each other all of 45 minutes and you're breaking down into a heap, it seems like a lot for the relationship.
Construction's very stressful.
A very superficial relationship we're having. Yeah, I would go into everyone's house. It was always weird because you were in their house. Yeah. So it was sort of intimate, like you're like working in their bedroom and stuff like that.
And you always wonder if like a worker is going to sexually attack you.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's always that feeling of like, this extreme, I don't know this guy.
Oh, yeah.
He's alone in my house.
Yeah, yeah. And left alone. And it was funny. It was always universal. The men were scared to make a decision without the woman's consent.
Sure.
So if the man was there and I said, well, we're just going to go ahead and go with the dark walnut instead of the cherry oak because they're right. No, wait till Sharon comes home.
Because you don't want to take shit about that.
No,
like I wouldn't pick a knob without Leslie. I wouldn't pick anything. I mean, if someone says, what about this carpet? I'm like, you have to talk to Leslie. The trouble I'll get into right now for picking the wrong carpet.
Yeah, it's not worth it. You got to pick your battles.
I would live in anything with any color just to not have those fights.
See, I'm exactly the opposite, which is, and I don't know. I bought a house I bought our house without discussing it with my wife.
Oh, well, that's bold.
Yeah, that's bold. And she brings that up a lot.
Here's my question for you, because your relationship is confusing me in several ways.
Please.
One is, how is it possible that you could buy the house and have her not kill the deal? And also the fact that she ultimately will enjoy the Graham Parker song and not get more upset and make you shut it off.
Well, the Graham Parker stuff... Again, I'm preaching to the Parker choir here, but when you listen, when I force her.
But she's not mad you're forcing her. It ends right there for me.
She gets in the car, and we just listen to the Up Escalator straight on through. She likes those songs. Yeah. Like, they're just good songs. Mm-hmm. It's hard to argue with a lot of those songs. It's not like... You know, my buddy who's sitting in front of you trying to get me into fish. You know, that's a hard sell. Like, look, I've not eaten any space cakes, and you're not sucking my dick, and I'm not staring at a kaleidoscope. It's fucking high noon, and we're in a car. This is a tough sell. The song's 80 minutes long, and it's not going to work. Like, but the Parker stuff is short, it's poppy, it's got good hooks to it, and they've never heard it before. So
it's a good woman. You're married to a good woman.
I'm married to a good, open-minded woman who says, I will give your... And I got her on to John Hyatt. So I started...
Oh, that's good.
I started...
I don't know if I could pull that off. A little bit, but not fully.
I got her on to John Hyatt, and then I moved her. Hyatt was what you call stepping stone. Artist, you know, that's like the weed. Now I got her on the smack. I'm going to get her mainlining to Parker any day now. Tie off, baby.
Now, I enjoyed your movie last night.
Oh, you did?
This doesn't have to be just talking about my movie.
Wow.
So you sent over your movie, and, you know, people send over movies, and you say, okay, I'm going to put this in. You don't know the quality level you're going to get when people slip you their movie. And so I'm like, okay, I'm gonna show Adam respect. I'm gonna watch this. I put it in at about 7 o'clock last night. I'm sitting with my wife Leslie and my daughter Iris. We let her watch R-rated things.
Sure.
And unless it goes violent.
Sure.
And I think I bet you I get 10 minutes out of Leslie before she wants 60 minutes.
Right.
And we watched the whole thing. We could not have had a better time.
Wow.
And the night before, I made her watch an art film that people think is a great, great art film, and then which she didn't care for, thought a lot of it was false. And she said, there's not one false beat in The Hammer. There's not one false moment.
Wow.
And we were laughing our asses off. And the whole time, we were like, this movie was great. How come I don't see this movie like that? It's on, like, HBO every 5 minutes.
Thank you. Couple things. I have a theory, and again, that praise coming from someone like yourself is
forget
awesome.
Me, Leslie. She was and laughing Leslie. Her ass off. We really did have kind of a great time, and with my daughter, and also the use of construction detail as comedy really was making us laugh hard. The Jane Lynch scene was super funny. All the scenes at work were really funny. But Leslie's tough. I would not be mentioning her name if she gave it to 8 minutes, because mm-hmm. most people don't get past the 8 minutes.
Right. I'll answer all those questions, and thank you. I have a theory that mm-hmm. I'd like to float first, which is, yes, people, I send the movie to people, especially people like yourself, and, you know, the batting average on them seeing it is usually very low because people are busy. Mm-hmm. But I have a theory, and I'm sort of a student of psychology, and the theory goes that most products are bad. Most DVDs that people, you know, I was on K-Rock long enough and had enough people hand me their band tapes and CDs and stuff like that. Now, as they're handing them to me and they're explaining they're sort of a combination of Pearl Jam and Up With People, and I'm already thinking to myself, okay, this is going, I'm not going to throw it into the garbage. Yeah. I will show you the respect of not throwing this in garbage in front of you, but this is never going to make it into my CD player.
But I wish my hand was a shredder, so
it'd be nice. Or cooler my mouth, because that'd be impressive. Or my ass, actually, would be the ultimate shredder.
I will listen to those things sometimes.
Well, obviously, watch my movie.
Yeah, so I think there's always a chance that Now, I not an enormous amount of stuff,
right.
But I have made the mistake of not looking at things that people said, oh, you should look at that. I didn't. Someone gave me Foot Fist Away, the Danny McBride, yeah. Jody Hill movie.
Sure.
And I had it sitting on my desk for 6 months. I did not bother to look at it. And then Adam McKay saw it, and him and Will Ferrell released it under their banner. And I just waited too long. And ever since then, I try to look at as much of it as I can. Tiny Furniture, the Lena Dunham movie.
Mm-hmm.
Someone said, hey, you should see that. I watched it that night. I'm like, I am not going to screw up again. I did with Foot Fist Away. And your movie as well, where I thought, well, this is great. It was really, really good.
I thank you. And I think psychologically, most people, friends included, assume it's going to suck.
Yeah.
Because they do the math. Like, look, it's hard enough to make a comedy. And it's hard enough for people who make comedies, for the professionals to make comedies. Mm-hmm. You don't do this. How are you going to do this?
Yeah.
And so there's a certain amount of healthy skepticism, and it's based in reality, which is every single time someone hands me one of these things, 9 out of 10 of them suck. So instead of seeing it and having to lie to you and say, hey, it was cute. That was pretty good there. Jane Lynch was fine. You cannot see it and thus protect yourself from having to lie, because it's much easier to say, you know what, I'm sorry, I just couldn't get to it, than lie, for most people emotionally.
I'm trying to think what I would have done if I hated it, because I guess I'm taking that risk by watching it, that if I hate it the next day I could say I didn't see it, or would I just look you in the eye and tell you what was wrong with it, which is probably what I would have done.
Really?
I think I probably would have told you what was wrong with it.
Just because as a professional...
To show you that respect, and then maybe it would be helpful to hear someone not bullshit you. I think I might have told you I guess it depends on how bad it is, because some things are so bad you feel like people are insane. You literally feel like, oh, this person's literally lost their mind. And then some things are too bad because they're like too dirty, or like their pitch is wrong, like it's really gross. What was, I thought, interesting about the movie was that the tone was just right on the money. It was just it was really funny, but it was realistic, and it was really completely tuned into your comic sensibility, in a way that was really surprising. And surprising that there's not more. And then I instantly thought, like, why hasn't he made another movie or done something else to follow this up, since this so clearly works so well, even if it's just to demonstrate to somebody else that you know what you're doing?
Because I don't get to make movies, because there's a list and you're on it of people that get to make movies, and then there's everybody else.
Well, who paid for it?
Well, we paid for it,
yep.
But we have to try to, you know, it's one of these things where people say to me all the time, hey, when are you going to make another movie? And I go, well, as soon as I find another $1 million laying around and I get another year off, I'll make another movie, except for I don't know when I'm going to get a year off, and I don't know when.
It's like a Howard Stern thing.
Yeah, it's
made
hard.
One really good movie, and you think, well, now he'll make another movie, but he's just basically too tired.
That movie was funny, because there's never a good time to make an independent movie. Meaning, the good time is when you're out of work and you're 21 and you're going to max out someone's credit card, but not when you're working. And I was working full-time doing morning radio and other jobs, and I was just getting up at 5 every morning and doing 4 hours of morning radio and so on and so forth. And I had a 2-week break, like a Christmas break, and I knew the shoot would be about 4 weeks or 23 days or 22 days or something like that. So I said, look, we can shoot the first two. Well, I have 2 weeks to shoot. I have twins who just came home from the hospital when we started.
That's
this is another
worst
one of those,
timing you ever
one of those
could
wife
have.
Things. But I said, I said to my agent, who was trying to talk me out of it the whole time, because, like, oh, you're not going to make any money. And again, how's this going to work out? And who wants to see you do this? And there's a lot of, like, you get punished in this town for being good at one thing if you want to try to do something else. Mm-hmm. You know, they go, well, you're a radio guy. Yeah. Radio guys get punished the
you
most.
You can't make a country album.
That's right. Jesus. You're reading my mind. Radio guys are, like, pretty low on the food chain, on the comedy food chain.
But you define yourself as a radio guy.
Well, I don't, but no one's going to let me make a movie is really how it worked. And I realized that. So I was like, well, we're going to have to make to make my own movie because no one's going to let me make, no one's going to have me star in their movie. It's a lot of like confusion. You want to do what? What makes you, a lot of like, why can you act? They always say that, like, what makes you think you can act? I'm like, you think Rob Schneider's a great thespian? You know, I mean, you don't have to act that
great. He was the copy guy. Come on.
Yeah, you just got to act.
It is a little surprising that your acting is good. That is one thing. When the movie starts, you're like, oh, wow, he can act. And then you do have a beat where you're like, why can he act?
Thank you. No, that's – look.
In a very positive way. You're like, wow, he's very likable and he can act and he's very comfortable with himself. And it's a very pleasant surprise. But I guess it is a surprise only because – was there something else you had acted in before that?
I didn't have a resume of doing like shitty.
Yeah.
I mean, I did some telenovelas in the 80s. But we hardly talk about those. No, that's the whole point. It's how can you be this morning show or this late night radio show or whatever personality and then do this? You can't do this or that. Yeah. You know, if somebody said to me, how do you think Paul Rudd would be as a morning radio show guy? I'd be, probably suck. Yeah. And then they'd go, why? And I'd go, because he's good at that other thing, that acting thing. And they'd go, yeah, but why couldn't he do a morning show? I'd go, please.
Well, like I hosted America's Top 40 once. I filled in for Ryan Seacrest. I don't know why he asked me to do it, but he did. And I spent the whole morning just making fun viciously of every single artists, but really making fun of their names and everything about their music. And then no one ever mentioned it to me ever again. I think quietly someone probably said, "What? How did this happen? This was a terrible, terrible mistake."
Yeah.
But I think what the real lesson of The Hammer is that, and it relates to like This Is 40, is there's a kind of a madness to making things. You know, when we made This Is 40, it's kind of a reckless act because my family's in it. I'm trying to say something really personal, but I'm also trying to be universal to everybody else. And it really could go wrong in a thousand ways that are humiliating and could cost people a lot of money. But you have to kind of just be so passionate that you have to make it. You have to just do it. And it's like the follow-up to The Hammer. You know, when you have an experience or you make something and you're proud of it, regardless of distribution issues or people wanting to give you money for the next one, the way people succeed is you go, fuck it, I'm making another one. I don't give a fuck. I'll make the next one for $100,000 with the new Canon camera. And if that's where someone's passion is, they have to do it. Lena Dunham's movie cost $45,000. And that's what's happening in film, which is the good stuff is cheap. A lot of the good stuff is, you know, going under $7 million or $5 million. Sometimes it's like the next Noah Baumbach movie I heard cost $500,000.
Right.
And so that's how good things are going to get made. And it's going to be hard to make expensive dramas or comedies, but
well,
that's the future.
You can't, I mean, obviously it's so funny because everything, if you just sit back and look at it, even stuff like starting a family, it all sounds insane.
Yes.
Like, how's this going to work? This is never going to work.
Something. With twins, it doesn't work at all.
It's just going to be a disaster. And, you know, and I'm sure that you have, that this momentum, like, you get a personal momentum, and it can be a positive or it can be a negative. I mean, you know that once you start doing things, it's easier to do the next thing. You become a kind of Richard Branson type or something where like you go, fuck it, I'm buying an airline. And everyone's got to go, are you fucking nuts? You're buying an airline? Yeah, why not? You know, and then but once you've bought an airline and got that running, is there any idea that Richard Branson can float where somebody in the room goes, no, boss, you're high. That's never going to work.
I'm going to start a record label and sign Janet Jackson for $40 million.
Right. I was, by the way, picturing you filling in for Seacrest with coming in at number 18, someone else who isn't Graham Parker. Her name is Keisha or J-Lo or something. But anyway, she's not Graham Parker. Yeah. So you get a momentum where you go, fuck it. And they all sort of build on each other, and you go, I can do the next one because I did the last one. And Do you know, I was thinking about this on the way in, and the scary part about making a movie is it's this thing of, there's always this fear that you get halfway into it and you look around and you go, maybe
this makes no sense at all.
Maybe this wasn't the finest idea. Hey, do you have that when something's good? Like, I don't know, something like 40-Year-Old Virgin, when you're having all those great scenes, just all those hilarious scenes. Was there a part of you that you got into that and looked around halfway at some point and went, Jesus Christ, this is going to be awesome?
There is. I mean, I try to edit the scenes as I go and make the editors like show me cuts of everything every day so I can get a feel for if it's working. But you are always terrified that you're completely wrong. So when we were making The 40-Year-Old Virgin, you know, we were coming off of Anchorman, and Carell was so funny on the set. I've never seen anything like it. He could just riff in that character all day long. And it was clear to me, oh, this is like the funniest guy ever. This guy is so on his game. It's ridiculous. And then a week before shooting started, there was a show that he was a supporting actor on. It was a series they made six of, and they were just burning it off. And he had a terrible part on a terrible show. And I just happened to see it like 3 or 4 days before shooting started. And I thought, well, it's okay. It's just a bad show. And it really scared me to my core that the movie was going to be bad, because I thought, oh, look how wrong things can go. And in something that's so wrong, look how Steve doesn't work at all. Like, you wouldn't know he's like one of the great comic geniuses from this. And it scared me.
And in Anchorman, he played such a crazy character. Yeah. Now you're asking him to play a straight character, essentially.
Yeah, I wanted him to play it subtle. I wanted it to be real. It wasn't like a loud, obnoxious virgin.
Right.
In fact, they shut the movie down after 3 days. The studio shut it down because they didn't get what we were doing. They thought it looked too much like an independent movie. They said that Steve looked like a serial killer, like Jeffrey Dahmer in his members-only jacket. And I think they just also didn't know if this subtle approach to the performance was working. And that'll scare you, too, when people think it's so unfunny that they pull the plug. And pulling the plug costs like $500,000. It's not
– right.
And that happens on every movie, not that you get the plug pulled, but there is a moment right in the middle where you do think, does this make any sense? I always think about the end. Like, does the end work? Like, will you feel like you've been through something and it's earned, or is it just going to peter out?
Right.
That's why I always shoot a lot of footage for the end, because, you know, it's hard to get at him. You know, there's only so many ends to movies. Either everything works out, everything kind of works out, everything doesn't work out, but they learned a lesson, or it's just like a Coen brothers' life is fucking awful and that's it.
Right.
And you're always hitting one of those categories and trying to do it in a way people haven't seen a billion times.
Like, well, the catch 22 of the ending is, especially taken from a guy who made a sports movie, because when you make a sports movie, you get 1.5 options on your endings. Like, does this guy win or does that guy win? And if you go, well, if it all works out, then everyone saw it coming, and but that was so easy.
Yeah. There's that was a twist. Great original. I don't want to give it away because I think that I am promoting this movie. It's probably on Amazon, and so I'm not going to give away the ending. But that, you know, we had that with Talladega Nights. Ricky Bobby just win the race, and then at some point someone realized, oh, maybe he doesn't, you know, and there's another way to go about it. And that's the hardest part about all these movies is that little grace note at the end that you land on. You know, my favorite one is the end of Terms of Endearment, because it ends at the funeral and Deborah Winger's dead. I mean, it should be the saddest ending ever, but it works because Jack Nicholson shows her kids his pool, and he's like, you want to see my pool? And suddenly there's hope.
Yeah, I love I don't know why I was thinking about Parenthood the other day.
Yeah.
And I was trying to picture the movie where it ends, and maybe I was thinking about your movie, but where it ends with the baby, and you think the baby is the baby of the daughter, but it's the baby of the mom, as I recall.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Definitely, we thought about Parenthood when we were making this.
It had
very similar
notes of that. I felt notes as one of my favorite movies in terms of lots of comedy, lots of truth, lots of layers, lots of laughs coming off of tension. You know, where there's a couple of beats where the movie is comfortable enough in its own skin to go, I don't have to dance and tell jokes. I can, we can have a serious moment or a mm-hmm. real moment here. And then the comedy is going to pay off that much more when we have just a couple of, like, where we're secure enough with our product that we can actually just be interesting for a moment and yeah. not be funny.
Yeah. And you feel when you watch it that it really is personal to Lowell Gans and Babalu Mandel, that that was their moment where they were on top of the world. They could do almost anything they wanted to do with Ron Howard, and they made something really personal that was real and funny. And that's how I felt, like, oh, I'm allowed to do this now. I probably won't be allowed to do this for long. I can slip this in and with a lot of freedom and to see what happens.
Well, what is – so then as I was watching, I was thinking, I bet Judd – I mean, so Judd has a serious side, and then the comedy could be born out of some of the pain or neuroses or whatever. But then I thought, you know, Woody Allen's done it, and other guys have done it. Bill Murray, different degrees of success. But I bet Judd has just a very straight movie in him, or that he's been thinking about or wanting to do. I mean, without. With something that would not be called a comedy.
I guess I just think everything in life is funny. So it's hard for me to go into full drama mode because I think that our whole existence is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. What we're up against is ridiculous. What we're in denial of is ridiculous. And so it's all ultimately comedic to me.
Right.
So when I see any movie that doesn't have any humor, I think there's something wrong with those people.
Right.
Because it's just, even at its worst, it's comic
right.
to me. But it's funny because we were talking about a review that came in for This Is 40, which is a positive review, but you could tell that person would rather there be less humor. Like the one criticism was that it was so funny that they wanted a little more settled down dramatic moments in it. And that is the dance of being funny, is once you're funny, you have to set a certain pace and rhythm for how funny you're going to be for an entire movie. And it is fun to be less funny sometimes. I enjoyed that in Funny People, you know, the dramatic scenes. Where I love it is I'm an executive producer on Lena Dunham's show Girls,
yeah,
where there is no audience. So we can do big scenes or full episodes that are not funny at all.
Right.
And it's fine. You can do that on TV now on shows like Mad Men, where they're, you know, it's all kind of funny, but they're dramas. That's the great space to do that.
Your daughters in the movie were unbelievably good. Like as I was watching, I was sort of just thinking, you know, this is a blessing and a curse. Like as a dad, mm-hmm. you know,
yes.
it's sort of like, you don't want your daughter to be a pig, but you don't want her to be Cheryl Ladd either, because you're going to have a bunch of dudes yes. calling up at all hours. And
yeah.
it's like you'd like them to be like, you know, attractive minus the huge rack and the ass that doesn't stop. You know, like you want them. You know what I'm saying?
I've had these talks. With
You've
my
had
wife
these
many
talks.
Times.
Yeah. Like, cute.
I say to my wife, is this ass going to stop?
When is this ass ever going to stop?
We want it to.
So, your daughters are so, Maude and Iris, are so compelling and so good in this movie. And then, of course, you have your wife as well. Like, I don't know what you do. Like, I mean,
exactly.
What happens when they just announce, look, I want to be emancipated. I want to be a scene.
I want to be like Drew Barrymore.
I'm dropping out of school. I'm hiring, you know, an attorney, and I'm moving on. Like, do you want that for them? Do you want to rein them in and go, look, this is a special occasion. Daddy directs you in a movie that he wrote, but you're not going out and starring in everything that comes out.
That's the debate that we have in the house all the time, which is when I think of a movie and want the kids to be in the movie, you know, it's partially because I don't want to meet other people's kids, and I know it'll
sure.
be so much better.
It's their
with
parents.
My kids.
It's not the kids. Let's be honest.
Well, sometimes the kids, but
oh, I like that.
but I know that if my kids, Leslie's kids are in the movie, we're going to get a dynamic that you've never seen in a movie before, with like a level of truth of how this family operates. And that was exciting to me. I didn't think a lot about if they were great. What I thought was, if they are awful, this is just a worldwide humiliation for my family if my kids are terrible.
Well, so, people are going to look at you as a narcissistic asshole, because yes, they're going to be like, look at this guy. Yeah. Wouldn't even hire professionals. Puts his own family in there.
Well, which I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind that. I just would be more worried about them. But so I tried really hard to make them, you know, to support them so they could do a good job. And they are really hilarious. They've been watching us do this for a long time. And they're good actresses, but they're really interesting people. So I was proud of that and proud to show that off. Where we get in trouble is, well, what if someone, you know, wants Maud to be in a horror movie that shoots in Shreveport, Louisiana for 4 months? Am I going to go be a stage dad and sit on the set and, you know, and watch that? And that's not really what the purpose of this was. So our theory is, this is it. This was just a one-time thing. Now, where that breaks down is my daughter suddenly getting offered something that we're jealous of.
I'm gonna tell my daughter.
Paul Thomas Anderson called Maud? What do we do? So we don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, it's funny. She's got like 90,000 Twitter followers, Maud.
Yeah.
And she's really interesting and funny. And she writes for all these internet sites like Hello Giggles. So I figure if I could teach her to do a lot of things,
mm-hmm,
you know, where she can act, but she also can write, and you know, she likes to sing and Broadway type stuff, then maybe, you know, she'll find something that she likes to do. But you don't want them needy for acclaim or needy for approval. Like, life isn't good unless I'm in a movie. That's
right.
The part that we don't want. We want this to be somewhat of an aberration, but also something that says to her, well, you have talents, work hard. Maybe you'll be able to do something.
Right. And you, as a former performer, don't pop up in this movie, I do believe. So you're sort of leading by example, which is Daddy used to slay audiences.
I did not slay audiences. I was
the
not
deli
very good.
Smoker
at the deli
on
smoker
Tuesday nights.
At Sammy's by the Shore.
Right. But Daddy slid gracefully behind the camera.
That's right.
Because
as the audience requested that.
Other muscles to flex. Yeah. So, and then what about you doing acting and some of these things?
You know, I did the only time I ever did is I did a cameo in Funny People, which I cut out, which was a funny scene where Adam was shooting a sequel to a hot dog eating competition movie. And I was the director, and I was trying to convince him to eat 5 hot dogs in one take because it was a big crane mm-hmm. shot. And there were no edits, and I had to need to see him eat 5 hot dogs in this one shot. And then it was Adam just going, no, not going to happen.
Right.
Not going to happen. And then I say, what if we do one take? And he's like, nah, not going to happen. What if I do it in 2 pieces? And it was just me convincing him to eat 5 hot dogs. And it was pretty funny, but the movie was long and I removed it. But my stiffness was what was interesting about it, because I've never been a good actor.
You know, it's a good ploy I would recommend for you in all your future endeavors. You just go talk to your AD and your, you know, the camera guys and everything, and go, look, don't roll on this one. Like, don't burn any film or digital or whatever. But put one scene for you in every, you know, whatever. You're playing the UPS guy, you're playing the director, you're playing whatever. And then you cut it out. It's never in.
Yeah.
The point is then when you get shit from whomever about cutting their shit out, you go, hey.
Yes, I cut myself out.
I cut myself out. I was the first guy cut out of my film. I know what it's like to be cut out of a film. Obviously, we're fat. We cut my scene out. So don't come complaining about your scene. You just put a little scene of you that's just waste. Yeah. That's just an appendage that could be cut off like a lizard's tail that would never grow back. You just put that in every single movie. No one would ever give you any shit.
That's a good idea. That is a good idea.
It was. Now I feel so, again, like so naive talking to Graham Parker the day before, going, did they cut you? Did he keep you?
Because
so much gets cut out. I didn't know he was in 10 scenes.
He was very, very good. Now, you know, here's the thing with Graham, to get back to the most important part of this.
Sure.
I knew I needed a guy who was willing to be on screen as a guy who can't sell any records, whose career highlights were behind him. So we were sitting around like, who should we get? What about the guy from XTC?
Sure.
You know, what about Joe Jackson? And we just made the list of all the people that we really like but who aren't selling a lot of records.
Oh, look sharp and I'm the man.
Nothing better, right? Nothing better.
Nothing better.
And the zillion records after that. And so we started trying to figure it out. And then a friend of mine said, look at Graham Parker's website. And he had written this essay about how he wanted to have his music in more movies, and he signed a new publishing deal. And I read it, and in the middle it said, are you reading Judd Apatow?
Wow.
And I thought, well, that is a sign. That's just a weird sign. And then I went and had lunch with him and started delicately telling him the story. And he was just so amused by the idea of the musician who can't sell any records anymore. Because you need a guy on set who's not going to be sensitive.
Sure.
When you talk about it, because it's unfair to most artists can't sell records anymore.
No, I've had that, like when I used to do the Man Show, you'd have that thing where it'd be like, yeah, no, Pauly Shore, we're really interested in having you do a reoccurring fee. Tentative working title douchebag of the week, but we haven't, obviously there's some room for modification. Pauly, but understand, it's an homage. It's not we're not making fun of you. Like I've had that.
It's a satire. It's like Larry Sanders. We would have to have those conversations with people at the Larry Sanders Show. The funniest one was Bob Goldthwait was on the show and was hilarious. He's always been one of my favorites, and he didn't realize that in all the scenes around him, people would be shitting on him,
right,
and making fun of him because that's how the show worked. In the next scene, whatever celebrity left, the writers were going to trash him. And he said to Gary, he's like, I didn't know that you guys were gonna do that. He goes, I think it just it bothered me because so much of what you said was true. Like, it really bothered me.
He is Bob's a friend and a very sensitive guy. I think a lot of comedians.
He's so great. I mean, I love what he's done. I mean, when you talk about just shooting that next movie, I lived with Adam Sandler when Sandler shot Shakes the Clown. I mean, this was one of the biggest moments in our lives. Like, what? Sandler is making a movie with Bob Goldthwait and Tom Kenny and Robin Williams was doing a big cameo in it. And I remember me and Sandler going to Bob Goldthwait's place, and then Robin Williams came over. Now, we're just like kids, and then suddenly Robin Williams is there. And our minds are blown. We can barely speak.
Sure.
And then, he was very quiet. He wasn't in, being funny mode, but then maybe just once he said one thing, oh, look at Prince. We were like, oh my god, that was the best moment of my life. Robin Williams did the voice.
I think he's like a cockroach, which is like he's either standing still or he's going 100 miles an hour. Don't see cockroaches jog.
Yeah,
not like a cockroach is sort of making his way across the kitchen floor, but it doesn't seem to have much purpose. It's either he doesn't have a dimmer switch. I think once either to get the Baptist minister or you get nothing.
Yeah, no, but Goldthwait, that was the big moment in Sandler's career. I remember he had the one joke where they say, what are you doing? And Sandler says, nothing, just been juggling and shit. And we thought that was the first laugh Sandler ever got in a movie.
How is it that everyone has managed? I feel like this town is either half of them are friends with Robin Williams and the other half is friends with Adam Sandler. And then there's me. I feel like I'm the only guy. I like both of them. I respect both of them. But everyone's like, oh, I mean, me and Sandler back at NYU or Robin in San Francisco. What happened?
But you came out of where? North Hollywood?
I came out of North Hollywood.
That might be the problem. You know, me and Sandler, we lived on Houston
Street.
Could have been
part of the problem.
We lived on Houston Street.
I grew up on Houston Street.
Yeah, that's where we lived, right by the Odyssey Video.
Yeah.
And we lived there in 1990, 91. So we should have
crossed.
What were you doing in 90, 91?
I literally grew up on Houston Street, which is spelled OU, not Houston. Maybe it's spelled phonetically. I'll figure that out. It's in my book. Anyway, I grew up on Houston. My family's house is on Houston Street in North Hollywood. And I got out of North Hollywood High, which was down Magnolia Boulevard there from Odyssey. Odyssey is a like a blimp hanger for porn.
Yeah.
And they had like that huge porn section in the back. Yeah, yeah, it was Houston with a U, right? It was like
it pretends to be, is it still there?
Yeah,
yeah.
The Odyssey, yeah.
It pretends that it's for normal movies, but really that's just a front to have 9 billion porno movies in the
right. And so I grew up there. I went to North Hollywood High. I got out of North Hollywood High. I started cleaning carpets, and I started digging ditches, and then I just started working construction. And I never really knew comedy was a viable, you know, way to make a living. And somewhere in the early 90s, I was living in La Crescenta with a couple of guys in a rental house. I was teaching boxing at a place called Bodies in Motion, and I was swinging a hammer.
Why didn't they pay for the movie? They got a lot of coverage.
I know Bodies in Motion got a lot of coverage. Yeah, I don't know. And by the way, if you want to know what I was doing, all you have to do is watch the movie. That's what I was doing. That guy Oswaldo was his name is Oswaldo, and me and him worked construction together.
Same guy.
Oh, yeah, like I was like,
he was good.
I'm gonna teach you how to act. As a matter of fact, I was like, you don't even have to act. Just be yourself. And then I realized nobody could understand Ozzy speaking. So if you watch the movie, you'll notice that every time he says something, I go, I'll repeat it, or someone else will repeat it. Yeah. So he'll say,
good hair.
Yeah, amazing hair. Yeah.
But who told you about comedy? What was the leap to do comedy?
I knew I was funny, and I knew I was good building shit. And so I just was very pragmatic about the whole thing, which is I would encourage everybody to do this, where you take a little inventory of yourself, but realistic inventory. Like, what are you good at? What are you not good at? What could you do and what shouldn't you do? I was a bad student. I was bad at many things, but I was very good mechanically, and I thought I had a good sense of humor. So the mechanical part, I was already doing, driving a truck, swinging a hammer and all that. And I knew that sucked. Like that was not a bunch of money and a life that didn't involve travel or women or intrigue or anything at all.
Well, you're in La Crescenta though.
Yeah. So I was in La fucking Centra and it sucked. So I was like, well, I do this and I'm good at this and this sucks. So there's this other thing, which is comedy, which I think I can do, which, you know, has potential. I mean, who knows? Look, I don't need to get to the top of the heap. I can just make a living. Yeah. I would have been more than happy just to write for a greeting card company or just get on some sort of animated show and just write jokes or something. And so I said, well, let's start pursuing that. So I went to the Groundlings. And then I eventually met Jimmy Kimmel, and I taught him to box because they were doing some radio stunt, and he got me on the radio, and, you know, one thing led to another. But lots of...
So you didn't start from stand-up. You started from...
I did a lot of open mics.
Yeah.
See, the stand-up thing is tough because when you're starting out, like yourself, like you and I, probably not put on this earth to do stand-up, but... You're funny enough that you can do stand-up, and because there's no other outlets or there were no other outlets, you end up... So it ends up being like this sport. It's kind of like you're in Mexico, and your sport is ultimate frisbee.
Yeah.
But they're like, we got a soccer ball.
Yeah.
And you're like, I like ultimate frisbee. And they're like, yeah, but we got a soccer ball, so play soccer.
But you're doing it now.
And you go, all right, I'll kick the ball around. And you're a good enough athlete that you could be good enough at soccer to kind of make your way onto the team. And, yeah, I do stand up now, and I do it sort of like you do your movies, minus the payday, which is I do stand up mixed with stories and then mixed with like some inspiration and some stuff, minus like joke, setup joke, whatever, like something that can be a little more personal and
what
a little
kind of
more
places?
Human.
Like theaters or what?
Yeah, theaters. And it depends. Town Hall, New York.
That's a big place. I saw Man, I've seen a lot of people at Town Hall. So Loudon Wainwright at Town Hall.
Some may say too big.
Well, how ticket sales
we'll
go?
See how that goes. I think we still got a few left.
Really? You need when me I to tweet few, it? You need I me need to tweet some plugs?
Oh, Judd, that would be massive. That would be massive. Yeah, and again, see, it's a weird thing because...
And you're with Dennis Miller at the City National...
Oh, yeah, Grove of Anaheim. Right.
I used to open up for Dennis. I opened up for him at the Dallas Improv.
I've been to the Dallas Improv. I think I have. Is it Dallas?
One of my first gigs ever was writing the pregame show to the Paul Simon Live in Central Park concert, and the pregame half hour before the concert was Dennis Miller just doing like a funny comedy special about Paul Simon. And so I got to hang out with Dennis, watch like the rehearsals, watch Paul Simon rehearse, and then go to the show where I had the pass where I could be in the front row. There's like 500,000 people there, and I could watch Paul Simon from like 1 foot away. It was like the greatest thing in my life.
Wow. Yes, you can't see him if you're more than 5 feet away.
That's true.
He's gotta be right up there.
He dips away quickly.
The earth, he goes around the curvature. Yeah, it's weird because like if I go to the Moore Theater in Seattle, 2,000 seats, and it'll sell out like that because I don't know why, but that's me and that's Seattle. And then it varies. Like some places, Boston, great. New York, usually good. Maybe the storm has slowed this one down a little, but with your tweet,
my tweet's going to have some impact.
We're going over the top. I lost my radio career, you know, 3.5 years ago, and I had to go out and do stand up like for a living for like the first time ever. And it was weird, and it was kind of good, sort of. I don't know, humbling and good in a certain way. Like,
it forces you to figure out what you're thinking about and who you are.
Yeah, and just to, like, physically get out and do it. Like it's so easy when you become an adult to get away from the things that aren't in your wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about this all the time, which is when you're young, you go, well, I'm no good at math. And someone goes, well, too bad, you have an algebra class. And you go, yeah, but I don't like algebra. And they go, well, go fucking crack a book and see if you can get better at it. And you just do it. And for the geeks, it's sports. And for the jocks, it's the classroom. But we all have, but you're forced to go out. You're a geek. You're still forced to try to climb that rope at gym class. And then you become an adult. And you go, fuck it, I'm never climbing another rope, or in my case, I'm never reading another book.
I'm like, mad when my kids want to play sports.
I never I'm never gonna go anywhere near any of the shit I'm not good at it. So if you're not good with music, you don't work on an instrument. If you're not good with language, you don't work on a second language. But then it kind of stunts growth in a certain way. You get really good at what you're really good at already. But you stay way the fuck away from the stuff that you might be better at than you think, but you're too insecure to go back there.
Like yesterday, I took a spinning class for the first time.
Really?
I went to Soul Cycle and took a spinning class. That is out of my wheelhouse.
Wow. You took a spinning class?
That's right. It only took me almost 45 years to get there.
And how was that?
My ass hurts today. It hurts, but I didn't get injured. It made my wife very happy to see me.
I was going
to
say
moving
this feels
quickly.
Very wife based.
Well, it made her very happy for me to go, and probably something I should go to. You do things like that,
like spinning.
Yeah, like a formalized exercise class thing.
No, I mean I
you box still is that
a little
your
bit.
Main thing?
Yeah, because I used to work in that world.
Yeah.
And it feels weird to go back as a civilian. Yeah. I'd rather be the guy walking around yelling your last easy day was yesterday and stuff like that rather than the person who's on the other side of that. And I was teaching my son how to box a little bit. He's six and having some fun with that.
Are these both boys or
a boy and a girl?
Wow. And was that it? You have two?
That's it.
Wow, you did it perfectly. You did it perfectly.
Yeah,
boy and a girl, because then they kind of like each other.
Right.
You don't have like a full-on sibling rivalry. Six is the best age ever.
Oh.
Six, it's like you're finally past them trashing the restaurants, and you could go out, and they start talking to you like real people, and they're funny and cool, but they will go to sleep.
And I was saying yesterday, you can actually like have them do some bidding. for you. Like their mind is awake enough that they could go to the kitchen and grab you a beer and bring it back to the room you're in, or go. They can go fetch things.
Sure.
And I said yesterday on my podcast, I was sitting at the park with them over the weekend, and I heard a junior soccer team, and the game was over, and they did a sort of 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we, you know, for each team has to congratulate the other team. And the one team said, Germany, Germany, yay, Germany. And I thought, what the fuck? First off, no one ever appreciated Germany. And I thought, this is weird. And I thought, did I hear that? I was 100 yards away, but I thought, this is funny. And I told my daughter, run out there and go ask them what team they just, and then run back. And she came back with both teams. And it was nice because I didn't want to walk up there.
And what was it?
It was Germany and Spain or something
that. That's the names they use in soccer.
They decide to go international. But then, like I said, it's going to get complicated because you have Mexico and you have, you know, Somalia, and you have some places that possibly into ethnic cleansing.
That's right.
You know what I mean? And then you have to go, who do we appreciate?
Chechnya.
Yeah, Chechnya. Yay. Yeah, it's going to get weird.
Yeah.
And maybe they won't go that deep.
Yeah.
But either way, just appreciating Germany sounds.
But they're all bummed they're on Germany.
I
are there Jewish kids on that team?
That's a very... That would be my next question to ask my daughter to go mule over
there. And how much will the parents complain?
I should explain, or at least take a moment and tell people that, Judd, I should give you some of my delightful mangria.
I'll take it. What is it?
It's like sangria.
I like it. I like it.
With a little punch to it.
Okay.
It's got...
Where do I get it?
Mangria. You can go to buymangria.com. Man knows how the game is played. I love that. And if you want to support the pirate ship, again, fired from my radio gig, and obviously my independent film career not paying the bills, you can go to adamcroll.com, and you can get any of Judd's movies, TV shows, any stuff you're going to get off of Amazon. You go to adamcroll.com, you click through the banner, then you get Judd's library.
And then you get a little taste.
And I get to wet my beak.
Okay, let's talk about what you could wet your beak with, because I have things that are coming out.
Please, please.
Okay, and you can help Adam, which is important. The soundtrack to This Is 40 with the music of Fiona Apple, Lindsey Buckingham, the Punch Brothers, Wilco, Avett Brothers, Yoko Ono, and Paul McCartney on the same record, Paul Simon. That's a good one. The movie Heavyweights, the first movie I ever wrote, comes out December 11th. You can buy that right now. You could pre-order that.
Wow.
On Amazon. Heavyweights. There's a whole documentary about us making it. A lot of outtakes of Stiller being mean to kids, which is fun. Also, ready? You're going to make some money on this right now. This is going to be a big day for you financially. Girls, season one DVD, also out around the 11th of December.
Great series.
You can buy the whole thing with the commentaries and the making of Girls, and it's actually really... really good. So those three things, Girls, Heavyweights, soundtrack to This Is 40, and also you could always buy Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared on DVD as well.
And also, just to speak about Girls, Lena Dunham would be one of the few chicks you could get caught beating off to and probably get a pass from the wife.
I don't think I would get the pass. I would.
Well, you're too close.
I'm friends with her.
You're too close.
It would create...
No, not you.
Yeah, not me.
One.
Other people.
One.
Other people.
Yeah, you get caught on the Milken and Poppin website.
Do you ever get a free pass? You ever get a free pass?
On the beating off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But to a specific person. I mean, you can get a free pass like, oh, I was alone, and you can say, I was thinking of you. But do you ever get a free pass where there's actually like a picture of someone else around or someone on the computer? I don't think you get a free pass.
Yeah. Oh, you mean like when I use the liquor store Takati girl cardboard cutout?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's not that you don't get a free pass on.
No. Well, how big a price would you pay?
Well, it's
how long would your wife hold on to that?
It's hard to tell. I don't know that, you know, she has a kind of a emotional Tupperware that gets burped quite a bit and doesn't seem to be affected by time or sunlight or anything else. Well, women have that. Guys don't in terms of I don't think I hang on to that much stuff, but it's usually because I'm tuned out when it's happening. So it's like getting in a fight when you're drunk.
Yeah.
It's just doesn't haunt your soul that much and doesn't impact you that greatly.
Yeah.
As long as there's no brain damage, it's much better to get into a fist fight when you're shit faced. And I'm sort of emotionally shit faced in a lot of discussions I have with people that are
you forget what you're mad about.
Yeah, I'm a little more reptile than human in that department.
Once, when my wife and I were in the middle of kind of a real fight, I literally fell asleep in the middle of the fight. And it was the middle of the day. It wasn't even night.
Wow.
I just literally fell asleep unconscious. And she was like, I cannot believe you literally just fell asleep. I'm like, I must have got stressed out. I just fell asleep.
Wow, you're like one of those goats.
Yeah. Exactly. I was like an alligator here, rubbed my belly. I just went down.
Wow. It is the goat that does that. I can't figure those fucking goats. The movie, and like I said, I was really trying to watch this movie because I wasn't sitting in a crowded movie house because it was a preview. But I really think this movie is important. I think it's really good. And I think it's not only a good movie to watch with your wife, and it's nice that you don't have to get into that, all right, flip a coin, whose turn is it this weekend? Are we going to see The Notebook? Are we going to see Transformers 5? Like, what are we going to see? I was proud of The Hammer because I'm proud that your wife enjoyed it and you enjoyed it as well. And I think it's nice to make something that kind of walks that line between the male and female and their different sensibilities. But I not only think Judd's new movie is important for couples to see, but I would urge bringing kids, probably 12 or older, to check it out as well, because you get it's just a very nice peek behind the curtain of really what's happening in people's homes, and even the homes that you don't think have these kinds of problems, or maybe they don't have the same problems that your home has, but rest assured there are problems.
Yes.
Well, and we all live in there. It is in theaters December 21st. You can go to the website thisis40movie.com. And again, I think your wife, Leslie Mann, is going to get some notices Oscar-wise for this. When does that all come out? This is December 21st, so it's this year. It's in Under the Wire. When do you hear about that? Or probably for good or for bad?
Probably in January, I guess.
We had Christoph Waltz on my program right after he did Inglourious Basterds, and I was like, buddy, you just won the Academy Award. And he was like, oh, please. You know, and I was like, you fucking won it in three different languages. Believe me, won it. And I just think Leslie was I know it's weird to talk about Oscar or whatever for comedies, but she was that good and just showed that much.
Well, I'm very proud of what she did, and I'm kind of shocked and amazed at what she does and what she's willing to do as much as anybody else.
It was just a tour de force, and Paul Rudd was great, and your daughters were great, and it's just a great and important film, and you guys should all go check it out. Again, in theaters, December 21st, This Is 40. And Judd, I'm going to make that next movie, goddammit.
Come on. What are you waiting for? Why are you denying us? That's what I thought. When it ended, I'm like, why would you not just go make another one? This one totally is great. Why stop? Come on.
All right.
Don't be lazy.
That's it. I'm going to make another movie.
Write it on the plane on the way to do the Dennis Miller gig.
I'm driving to that, but on the way to Town Hall.
Town Hall.
I'm going to ride it.
Tickets still available.
All right. So, this is Adam Carolla saying, mahalo.